Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today we're talking about film history. We are joined by the founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation. He is a film preservationist, a festival programmer, a San Francisco literary laureate, and the host of Noir Alley on the Turner Classic Movies channel. And he's coming to Portland for the upcoming Noir City Film Festival. Eddie Muller, welcome to Words and Pictures.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And congratulations. You just told me before we came on that you've been doing this for 20 years, and I've been doing my festivals for 25 years now. So congratulations on the durability.
The stick-to-itiveness. That's right. There you go. Well, Eddie, let's start with a little bit of background. Our audience is pretty shrewd, but not everybody is steeped in film history. Give us a few of the basics about the film noir genre.
It's funny. Right off the bat, we can get into a discussion of, is it in fact a genre or not? Because this is something that people talk about all the time. So I call it, I mean, most of the films are in what you would call the crime genre, but that doesn't quite get to the gist of it. It was an artistic movement. And for our purposes, we'll talk about this in terms of American films and Hollywood. Although we've learned that, as the upcoming festival will show, that it crossed borders, obviously. And so not all the movies were from America in mid-20th century. But there was an artistic movement in which this style of filmmaking became very prevalent without there being necessarily an economic reason for that. And, you know, in American movies, nothing begets success, like, you know, copying something. But it was just interesting that this was driven by the artists. The writers wanted to write things in a certain way, and the directors were very drawn to this visual style, and the cameramen started shooting things a different way. And then the actors got into it saying, yeah, I'd like to kind of sully up my good guy image by playing somebody who is a compromised protagonist. And that's where you ended up seeing, you know, people like Fred McMurray and Tyrone Power playing bad guys in movies instead of their usual, in Power's case, swashbuckling hero or lightweight leading man. So it was a very interesting artistic movement. All kinds of reasons for it that we can talk about, but that was basically it. And they're crime films. You know, if amateurs are committing the crimes, they're called murder dramas. If professionals are committing the crimes, they're called crime thrillers.
Well, you can talk about noir films that go back to the 30s or even further back, but in the post-war era, the 1940s and 50s, that was kind of the high point. And studios were still not generally giving these noir films the big budgets. You know, the so-called A movies were musicals, historical epics, family comedies, dramas. The noirs were often lumped in with the B movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And they didn't need a lot of money to make these films, which is one of the reasons why it became a movement. Because remember, this is coming out of World War II. I mean, the movement started during World War II, even preceded it a little bit. But during the war, there were economic constraints on how much money could be spent on a film set. You know, $5,000 was the maximum that a studio was allowed to spend on a movie set during the war. And so crime pictures, by their very nature, are kind of low budget because the action is taking place in the margins, right? You don't have big sweeping vistas. There's no frontier to explore. There's, you know, no hordes of Roman centurions or anything. It's just, you know, people in hotels and corner bars and stuff like that. So the movies were inexpensive to make. But the writers loved doing it because, you know, even to this day, let's face it, a lot of directors starting out make something that could be called a film noir because it's not a big budget thing. You know, when you look at the Coen brothers making Blood Simple as their first film, that's obviously a riff on film noir, and it didn't cost them a lot of money. And the same thing always applied. So, I mean, even if you call it film noir or neo-noir or whatever, these are stories about people who they live lives of desperation in the margin of society. Ergo, you don't need a huge budget to convey that.
And we think of the big players in film noir films as being like grizzled men. But one of the things that film noir offered was great complex roles for women.
Absolutely. Next year, Running Press is coming out with an updated and revised edition of my book, Dark City Dames, which specifically just looked at actresses who were sort of synonymous with film noir. And yeah, the roles are fantastic. And I know what you're saying, that people assume it's a very male-dominated genre, because most films were back then, you know, especially if they were crime films. But that's what made film noir to me so interesting, is that there were women who were allowed to be the protagonists of these movies who had their own desperate situations, right? And so you get, you know, the battle between Barbara Stanwyck and Joan Crawford, like who's the queen of film noir, right? And you know, you can throw other actresses into that mix as well. Some of their most famous roles, Rita Hayworth in The Lady from Shanghai, or Ava Gardner in The Killers. Ida Lupino, of course, made a big impact in noir films. Yeah, and people always say, does it have to have a femme fatale to be a film noir? And I say, no, they don't have to, but those are the best ones.
And, you know, a lot of these films were really overlooked. They were sidelined until somewhere in the late 1950s. There was a respected French journal, Cahiers du Cinéma, and many of the writers there championed film noir, including some writers who later became filmmakers like Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was a huge thing. The French recognized what was happening as a movement in Hollywood more than the Americans did at the time. And the French have always had a way of appreciating what Americans did best. And in this case, it was kind of hard-boiled stuff. And they loved the language and the look of the films. Of course, the look of the films is partly due to European emigres who came to Hollywood in the 1930s. Well, people always like to throw around the term expressionistic approach to directing these movies, but it was just a more stylized and highly theatrical approach to the visual storytelling. And when that was combined with a distinctly American approach to language, that was really the chemistry that made film noir explode, if you will, in the Hollywood laboratory. It was really this the language combined with a new, very dark and shadowy look to the films. And yes, all those filmmakers, Godard and Truffaut and Claude Chabrol and Louis Malle, yes. And it's funny because sometimes it was so confusing that by the time film noir was heralded, really kind of in the 60s, you know, some of the film directors who had fled Hollywood because they were blacklisted were making films in Europe, and Americans thought they were French or that they were European, right? Jules Dassin, who I grew up, everybody said Jules Dassin, mm-hmm, because they thought he was French. And it's like, no, he's Julie Dassin. He's from Brooklyn, New York. You know, they just blacklisted him in Hollywood. So he ended up going to France and making this fabulous movie, Rififi, that's like the best heist movie ever made. And it's so that's what I mean. There's a lot of cross-pollination that was happening at this time between cultures where the films were influencing each other.
Well, we mentioned that you're coming to Portland and you're going to be showing off some real classics here. I think the one that might be really familiar to a lot of people is In a Lonely Place, starring Humphrey Bogart. There's The Man Who Cheated Himself. There's Night Has a Thousand Eyes, Never Open That Door, The Window, and Gilda. Tell us a little bit about, this is obviously a selection that you've personally curated.
Yes. And I found that, you know, it's interesting. When you start out doing this, or at least when I started out doing this, I was already, you know, I was older when I first started programming films. I was, what am I going to say? I was in my 40s. I was like 40 years old or something. And I had been watching movies for a long time, and I wanted to show all the rare stuff because it was so exciting to realize that there were movies that just never got shown anymore on a big screen. But after you do this for a while, you realize, wow, you know, there are a lot of people, it turns over. So, right, when you do something for 25 years, I realize I have people coming to the theater to watch these movies who were not born when I started doing this. And so you do have to keep going back to the well to show the established classics like Gilda, right? There's a whole generation that have not seen that movie. It's probably one of the most popular, you know, it certainly wasn't called a film noir when it was released, but it was a hugely popular movie when it was made because Rita Hayworth was just the biggest star in Hollywood at that moment in time. Conversely, a film like In a Lonely Place was overlooked when it was released in 1950, and only now it has established this reputation as one of the great films of its time. So when we program this, we want to show things that are like touchstones for people who maybe are experiencing it for the first time, maybe have seen the film but haven't seen it on a big screen, which is always great, and then combine them with films that are considered somewhat rarities like Night Has a Thousand Eyes and certainly Never Open That Door, which is a Spanish language film from Argentina that my foundation just restored this year. But it's based on stories by Cornell Woolrich, who was arguably the most prolific writer of noir fiction in America in this era. And his fame was such that, you know, this Argentinian director came to the United States specifically to get the rights to these three stories that comprise the film and did a magnificent job directing it. It's as good as any adaptation of Woolrich made anywhere at any time. You kind of have to combine the well-known stuff, realizing that not everybody has seen it, you know, and then pair that with some real rarities that you're only going to see at our festival.
And Cornell Woolrich, you mentioned, one of the most prolific writers whose work was adapted for the screen.
Absolutely, yeah. He's the guy. I mean, I think I haven't actually added this up, but it feels to me like the two writers of at least of suspense and thrillers and things who have been adapted more than anybody else are Woolrich and then Stephen King. I mean, Stephen King veers more towards horror than the thrillers that Woolrich wrote, but those guys, it's like everything they wrote ends up getting adapted to film because they're great idea writers. You know, it's like, wow, here's a great premise for a story. Woolrich couldn't quite land the stories all the time, but they sure engage you. Anyway, I think people will be knocked out by Never Open That Door.
Now, you mentioned that the Film Noir Foundation is preserving and restoring films. You're dealing with films that are almost a century old in many cases, and they weren't always valued at the time. So this must be, in some cases, a real challenge for you.
Yes, it's very interesting because in this country, the challenge is to, it's not like the films aren't somewhere in some vault preserved. In this country, it's more a challenge of ownership and rights clearance and just dealing with the massive bureaucracy that owns the art. In other countries, they really didn't have an established archive or anything to properly preserve the films. So when you get overseas and you're in Argentina, we've preserved and or restored, I think, 5 or 6 Argentine films now. And in some cases, that's it. I mean, we got the last existing copy of the film. Or in the case of, you know, some of these, like it's the last negative. I mean, we restored a film called The Bitter Stems that we found the only negative that we could find was like a brick. It was so improperly stored that it was soaked in motor oil for months. That was the treatment to save it. That wasn't to damage it. That's what saved it, was the film soaking in this motor oil to make it supple and loosen it up. And then it cleans right off. And then we could actually work with the negative. weird as it sounds, that was how it was done.
You didn't have vinegar syndrome on that one then?
No. And as you know well, vinegar, when you open the vault and it smells like somebody's tossing a salad in there, that's a bad thing. That's a really bad thing. Because it is like the communicable disease in films. And that vinegar syndrome can actually jump from film to film, even if they're in cans and sealed and everything. So when we want to do a restoration, we try to find as much material as possible. Like when we restored Too Late for Tears, it was, I mean, everything we could get our hands on, 35, 16. And it was very complicated patching it all together. In some cases, we used 3 and 4 different sources within one scene, like picking and this shot from this print and this shot from that print, and just to get the best possible version you can get.
Do you steer clear of that AI upgrading kind of thing, or do you play around with that?
We have so far used no artificial intelligence in the process of what we do. I'm sure the day is coming where that will happen. You know,
I think it's better to have the occasional little mistake or glitch.
Oh yeah, that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, mm-hmm. I watch the films and it's like, did it work? I mean, does the film work? Does it flow properly? I mean, we recently did a restoration of a film called If I Should Die Before I Wake, which originally was part of No Abras Nunca Esa Puerta. And the negative was damaged. And it was going to be so expensive to try to bring this all the way back, right, and perfect it. And that would have required some artificial intelligence stuff, which I'm not saying I'm wholeheartedly against an application like this. I mean, in this case, the AI would have been used to, it's just like in Photoshop or something. Mm-hmm. It just goes in and fills in, you know, it's like antibodies that go in and see where part of the film is degraded and they just guess, you know, well, we'll take what's next to it and we'll add that and this. And then the next thing you know, it's like patched up. Right. And it's just an AI thing. But it's expensive. It's expensive to do that. And we just said, well, let's restore this as best we possibly can and see how it works. And people loved it. I mean, I showed it on TCM and nobody remarked on the condition of the film. Everybody just said, wow, that was fantastic. You know, as long as you just tell them up front, like this is the best we could do with the material that existed. And then they're prepared for it to be like partially unwatchable. And it certainly wasn't. It was just like listening to an old 33, you know, album or something. It's just, you're going to get a couple of pops and hisses and things on occasion, but it doesn't affect your enjoyment.
Yeah, I've been around long enough to see Metropolis get longer and longer with, more grayed out of focus parts, but yeah, that's great.
Well, those added parts were from a 16 millimeter print, because that's my colleague, Fernando Martin Pena.
Oh, nice.
The guy who turned me on to No Abras Nunca Esa Puerta is the guy who discovered Metropolis in 2008. It's the same guy. And when I met him, he said, you know, Eddie, it's not just Metropolis. There's a lot of stuff, you know, there's stuff that people don't know about at all. And I've been, you know, fortunate that I'm in a position where I've been able to help restore 5 or 6 of those Argentine films that are really fantastic.
Wow, that's amazing. Just, I did not know that much about the Argentine preservationists. So now I know a little bit more.
That's because there's one.
Oh, okay.
it's Fernando, pretty much.
Oh, wow.
You know, there really isn't a system in place. Like there's no national film archive or anything like that in Argentina. So it's not easy. So, you know, Fernando has expressed to me how grateful he is that we've been able to restore these films. Obviously, we're not restoring them in Argentina. We're getting the materials to UCLA in Los Angeles, and we're doing the work here to restore those films. Then we share the results with Argentina, and it goes into Fernando's own personal collection, because he is, for all intents and purposes, he is the Cinematheque in Buenos Aires.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just very interesting that, you know, it's only been recently that people have learned about the life expectancy of film. And now they have to learn about the life expectancy of digital, because people think that digital is everything, but it's not an archival medium, really, at least not yet. And it's, and anybody knows that who, you know, they bought VHS tapes or they bought CDs or something, and then everything switches to Blu-ray, and it's like, well, you better have saved your DVD player if you want to watch those things. And don't get me started on streaming, because streaming is so dangerous, because somebody owns that stream. Somebody has the power to turn the spigot on and off, and it's not us. So if that's how you're getting your movies, I mean, just realize that at some point they can just say, yeah, we're not showing that anymore. And it's gone. It's gone. You know, so when we restore and preserve films, we preserve them photochemically, by and large, and we keep them in a collection that's the Film Noir Foundation collection at the UCLA Film and Television Archive. So they will, when we preserve them, they will always be there, and they will always be available for screenings and stuff like that. But it's very tricky with streaming.
Yeah, hold on to your physical media.
Good advice.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counsor. And today we're talking about film history. Our guest right now is Eddie Muller. He's an author, a film preservationist, founder of the Film Noir Foundation, and the host of Noir Alley on the Turner Classic Movies channel. And he's coming to Portland for the upcoming Noir City Film Festival. Well, I do want to circle back to something you said earlier. You're talking about neo-noir films, the Coen brothers with Blood Simple. That kind of kicked off this trend in the 1980s and 90s of a new generation of filmmakers who built on the noir genre. There was John Dahl with Red Rock West, Tarantino with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, David Lynch with Blue Velvet.
Yep. Chris Nolan, of course, started out making a kind of noir. His first film following in black and white that he made in England was definitely a film noir. They're just all kinds of filmmakers, you know, the ones who've gone on to be famous. I mean, I was impressed that you pulled John Dahl out there, because, I mean, he really had a feel for this, you know, The Last Seduction and Red Rock West. And he's done a lot of really good work. But, you know, I just saw my buddy Carl Franklin the other day, the writer director, you know, and he did One False Move, which is a fantastic film that I love, and Devil in a Blue Dress with Denzel Washington, which is like a classic, you know, detective story, but with a black detective. So, yeah, a lot of filmmakers get into this early in their careers. You know, you can really see the influence that noir had on them, either from the movies or from the books, because the Coen brothers are extremely well read. They know their Pulp Fiction inside and out, you know, and it continues to this day that people are like, I have to tell you, I get emails all the time from people saying, if you have a chance and want to look at my first film that I made, it's a homage to film noir. And yeah.
Yep, I think every film student, that's kind of their first, because like you said, they're cheap to make.
Exactly, exactly. And they're very dynamic. You know, I mean, everybody kind of gets it. You get the visual approach to these stories that the filmmakers have, and it's just so stylized. It's always funny when people describe film noir as realistic, and I say, in what world do you think these films are realistic? They may be dealing with, you know, really intense human emotions and stuff, but the approach is not realistic at all. It's super stylized. The acting, the dialogue, the cinematography, you know, these are not realistic movies at all.
Well, in the more recent films in the noir genre, do you think there's a more ironic sensibility, more dark humor? Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. And it wears me out sometimes, because initially these films were some of the noir films are very, very serious. They're very serious movies about the most dire aspects of human nature, the most, about the corrupt aspects of our culture and society. And some of them are just fun, right? And I think recently filmmakers have shied away from anything. Like, you know, do you really take Tarantino movies seriously? I mean, they're great fun. They're great to watch, but they're about movies. He makes movies about movies. And not all film noir is like that. You know, so there's the hardcore stuff, and then there's the let's just pay homage stuff, you know.
So are there hidden layers to some of the older noir films that modern audiences may not appreciate? Social, political themes?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, and it's so one of the things that makes it so interesting to me, and especially when I present films for younger audiences today, is they don't realize that there was a production code in effect and that there were things you could and could not do on the screen. And it becomes as a revelation to younger people to realize it wasn't just that acting was corny. It wasn't just that, you know, Hollywood movies weren't that realistic. It was like there was an establishment that was forcing the films to be that way. And so the filmmakers had to be very, very creative to work around the code. So you could tell stories that were very adult and had dealt with some ideas. Like Gilda, for example, that we're showing is a film that when I, 25 years ago, when I first started doing this and I showed that movie and I said, you know, this is probably the most perverse movie made in Hollywood ever up to that point because of the sexual dynamics of the film. And a lot of people were like, you're crazy. That didn't happen. And I just wanted to say, seriously, you didn't think there were bisexual people in the 1940s? You didn't think that this stuff existed? It's just that they weren't showing it on movie screens. You had to find a creative way to do it. And so it was very interesting when I was researching that book I mentioned, Dark City Dames. I became very good friends with Evelyn Keyes, who was one of the actresses I profiled. And she had been married to Charles Vidor, who directed Gilda. And when I said, you know, I've always thought this was happening and that this was, and she was like, oh my God, of course, you know, Charles snuck so much stuff into these movies. And we watched the movie together and she confirmed like, this means this. And it's all symbolic, but it's all there. It's all intended to be there. You know, I remember showing The Big Combo one time in Hollywood, and I had Earl Holliman as a guest at the screening. And Earl Holliman, I don't know if you've seen that movie, but he and Lee Van Cleef play hitmen in that film. And clearly these guys are gay in the movie, right? And there was dialogue that was just outrageous to get this across, but no one in the censor's office called it out because it was so subtle in a way that saying you got it like was revealing something about you that they didn't want to say. So they just got all this stuff in the movie, and Earl Holliman was like, you got that? You actually feel? And I said, oh man, it's so obvious. He goes, yeah, well, we thought we were really pulling one over on these people, you know. And anyway, so it's very, to me, all that stuff is very, very amusing, you know. The first film we restored, The Prowler, was just filled with this stuff that couldn't be spoken out loud. You know, there's like a lot of things going on under the surface of that movie that the code would not allow up on the screen. But you have to infer things, you know.
Well, there's a Portland film writer, D.K. Holm, who's written about an offshoot of film noir, sort of a counterpoint called Film Soleil. That translates loosely to sun film, but but the sensibility of these movies is anything but sunny.
Like Purple Noon, like Plein Soleil, the Alain Delon, the adaptation of talented Mr. Ripley, which was interesting to see that come back as a streaming show on TV in black and white. That was pretty amazing. I kind of hope that one of these things in black and white will be successful so that it's not like a huge deal anymore to do a show in black and white. I mean, every once in a while it happens, and I just, it doesn't make a big deal. You know, I finally saw Frances Ha, you know, the Greta Gerwig film, and it was, I didn't realize it was in black and white. And it was like, wow, this is great. And there's no reason it has to be in black and white. It's certainly not a film noir. But I'm confounded that more films aren't done these days in black and white.
Yeah, I can't imagine Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man any other way, that Robbie Mueller cinematography that just shimmers like silver. Unfortunately, you can't really watch it on the TV because you miss all the layers of shadow. And I think that's why you don't see so many TV series or streaming series in black and white, is that you miss those layers of depth of shadow.
It could. I mean, the Coen brothers, when they did The Man Who Wasn't There, I mean, that was just terrific. But of course, they shot it in color, and they just delete the color, you know, in post-production, because it all gets done digitally. And so taking the color out is pretty simple. It's interesting because a lot of people ask me, like, one of the more common questions I get is, can a film in color be considered film noir? And my approach to that is just, well, turn the color off. When you're watching it on a monitor or something, just turn the color off and see what you think, right? I mean, there's a picture from the early 50s called Niagara, a Marilyn Monroe picture. And people say, well, that's not really noir because it's in color. And I say, watch it sometime with the color off and tell me that's not a film noir. I mean, it's full on hardcore film noir. It just happens to be, you know, the majesty of Niagara Falls and all this stuff. But when you drain it of color, it suddenly looks very noir.
What was it Orson Welles said? Black and white is the actor's friend.
I get that totally. Yeah.
We mentioned that you're an author. Your books include The Distance, a crime novel, Dark City, the lost world of film noir, and an authorized biography, Tab Hunter Confidential, The Making of a Movie Star.
Yep. All of those. I did write all of those. Yes.
Well, I'm wondering, because Tab Hunter was a mid-century heartthrob and sort of the furthest thing from a film noir figure. What made you team up with Tab on this book?
We'll go right back to Evelyn Keyes again. I mean, that's how important Evelyn was in my life. Is she was friends with Tab, and Tab was trying to get just a book together to sell, and, you know, a memoir of his life. And he had worked with a few writers previously that he did not get along with. And Evelyn mentioned me to him because we had known each other for a year or so. And Tab read my profile, if you will, of Evelyn in the book and said, wow, this is her. I mean, he really captured her. And so we met and talked about it, and I agreed to do it. It was great. I mean, let's face it. I had written several books before that, you know, are film books, and I was not on TCM or anything. So, you know, there's no real money involved in any of that stuff. But then writing Tab Hunter's autobiography actually had money involved in it. And Tab was a phenomenal collaborator. He was great. I mean, we were co-authors of that book. I did not necessarily ghostwrite it. And I was really grateful that he was as generous as he was in presenting me as the co-author. Instead, you know, a lot of people who do an autobiography, they kind of hide the collaborator, they hide the writer. Tab didn't do that. I mean, he brought me along on tour with him on occasion, and we had a really good relationship.
Yeah, he seems like a real character. I mean, the first Tab Hunter film that I saw was a very odd Paul Bartel film, Lust in the Dust, where he starred opposite Divine, the famous drag actor.
Yeah, yeah. Divine and Lainey Kazan were in that. Yeah. Yes, that was significant. That was after Tab had his comeback making Polyester with John Waters. And that was
Smell-O-Vision.
Yeah, exactly.
Or Smell-O-Rama, I think.
Smell-O-Rama, yeah. And Tab did do one. It's not a film noir at all, but it's very interesting. I think it was Curtis Hanson's first movie. It has many titles, but it was first called The Sweet Kill. And Tab plays a homicidal maniac in the film. It's kind of a psychological thriller, but it's also kind of a slasher film. And he gives a really scary performance in it. And he's kind of long-haired and has a beard. He doesn't look like Tab at all. It was good. I think it eventually it was made by Curtis Hanson, released very briefly as Sweet Kill. He plays a character named Eddie, which I thought was interesting. And then Roger Corman, I think, bought it and retitled it The Arousers. Which I don't understand at all, but I think it must have made money because Roger Corman, may he rest in peace, knew how to sell films and make money.
He never lost a dime.
Except on his personal projects that he really loved. I think he did some like aviation movie with World War I biplanes or something that was his dream, and that's the only one I think that lost money.
Well, you're bringing some really notable examples of film noir to the Hollywood Theater in Portland. They're all going to be shown on the big screen, the way the original filmmakers intended.
I love the sound of that.
So starting on July 19th, there's Gilda, there's The Window, there's No Abras Nunca Esa Puerta, also known as Never Open That Door, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, The Man Who Cheated Himself, and In a Lonely Place, and it all goes through July 21st.
Yep. Starting on the 19th, going to the 21st. And Night Has a Thousand Eyes is also a Cornell Woolrich. So almost, I think, half the movies we're showing are based on Cornell Woolrich stories, because The Window is also a Cornell Woolrich story. Night Has a Thousand Eyes and No Abras Nunca Esa Puerta, Never Open That Door. Those are all Woolrich movies. So, right, that's half of them. They're all really great.
And the Noir City Film Festival will be featuring not just films, but other events. You'll be hosting a conversation on July 20th.
Yeah, that's fun. The guy who really is responsible for getting me up there and is like shepherding this whole thing is Ted Herleman, who is on the board of the Hollywood Theater. And Ted will be in conversation with me. It's Saturday afternoon, I think. And I really enjoy doing that, because it gives me an opportunity to speak a little differently than just introducing the movies. You know, I have a thing that I do when I introduce these movies, but to be in conversation, I really enjoy having the opportunity to speak a little more off the cuff and informally.
All right. You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we've been talking today with Eddie Muller. He's an author, film preservationist, founder of the Film Noir Foundation, and the host of Noir Alley on the Turner Classic Movies channel. Eddie, it's been great fun. Thanks for joining us.
It has been an absolute pleasure. I thank you so much for inviting me to do this, and I want to sign your guest book when I'm in Portland.
I look forward to that. How can our listeners find out more about your work and about the Noir City Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater?
Well, I apologize for the long URL, but if you go to filmnoirfoundation.org, that will tell you everything you want to know about the foundation, and it links to our noircity.com website, which lists all of the festivals that we do around the country. Portland is now part of a network of festivals we do around the country, because we also are in Hollywood and in the San Francisco Bay Area and Seattle, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Portland. We've been in other places as well. But, you know, I've been doing this, like I say, for 25 years. So I don't know how many more of these we're going to add to the circuit, because I'm just running out of gas at some point. But it is great fun. So that's how people can find out about those things. And then there's eddiemuller.com. That's my personal website, which really needs to be updated pretty soon.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.
We'll be right back.